Welcome to ICOSA's Driving Force Radio, where we discover what drives today's leaders. Now, here's your host, Jan Mazzotti.
Good morning, and welcome to Driving Force Radio, where we seek to discover what drives today's leaders. On the show today, my co-host is Kelly De La Torre, an independent energy attorney here in Denver, Colorado. Kelly really focuses and brings such great content to the show in the energy industry, both new energy, traditional energy, and today's show is no different. And Kelly, we have a great guest today. We have John Spisak, the CEO of Colorado-based Solar Rover, a mobile solar-powered generator company with just multitude of applications.
Yeah, this is an exciting show, and welcome to the show, John.
Thank you.
Welcome, John.
We're talking about, once again, talking about solutions and how advanced energy can bring cost-effective solutions to the energy space and actually to private industry and to, like you said, it's multifaceted.
Well, and what's interesting about it is typically when we're talking about solutions, we're talking about these reactive solutions.
Right.
And the beauty of today's show is it's really about a proactive solution to all kinds of issues that face our country and face our world. And, you know, it's cost effective. It's mitigating downline costs for all kinds of organizations. And that's what makes this such a fun show.
Yeah, and luckily we have John here today to explain to us that his technology, we don't need subsidies. We don't need all of these things that help, that have been effective in helping get the renewable energy industry going, but that, like you said, we can use a proactive stance and really fix some of these issues. And John, first of all, thanks for coming.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
And could you give a little bit of an introduction about Solar Rover and what this mobile generator is?
Well, Solar Rover is a company that produces generators, just like generators that you're used to using. These are solar powered. They have a full complement of batteries. They have a very sophisticated programmable energy management system so that they can manage solar power. They can even incorporate and manage wind power. And the best feature is that they can be created, and all of our units are, as pure hybrids. So they can function just like a Prius and give you maximum fuel efficiency if you are going to use a generator, maximum life, and really minimize the logistics, maintenance, and fuel costs.
So, John, I want to talk about some of the solutions of the Solar Rover generators, because if I understand it correctly, they come in various sizes and they can be used for various things. Can you talk about how they're used out in industry and what industries you're seeing really sort of embrace this technology?
Well, wherever you would use a generator, in particular using a generator either off-grid or for an emergency backup system, is where it makes the most sense. Backup generators, we see them everywhere, and especially in parts of the country like the Southeast where storms and disasters are ubiquitous, everyone's got a backup generator. The problem with diesel or propane generators, it's like a wired phone system or a game controller. You cannot escape the logistics. Someone has to resupply the fuel. Someone has to store it. When the generator's running, someone has to routinely check the air filters. They've got to change the coolant. So you're always tethered to some complex set of logistics when they're in operation. If it's years between storms, someone has to go out every month and start that generator. They've got to make sure it works. They've got to make sure the fuel is clean, that it hasn't degraded, or there's no water contamination. So what we've done is we've made the system wireless. We've eliminated that tether. We can put these units in the field. We can walk away from them. They're programmed. When the sun comes up in the morning, they refill the tank with fuel, and then the generator can produce that fuel as necessary. The other critical advantage and the critical benefit is that there's no reason to keep these in storage because they're zero emission and they're silent. They can be plugged into the building and they can be offsetting the electric power utility bill. And at the same time, they're telling you every day on their own that they're perfectly functional and they're ready to go in the case of an emergency. You don't have to send somebody out to check once a month and start them up and review the fuel, because they're operating every day, they're offsetting your utility bills, and you know they're ready to go when you need them.
The other aspect of it is that when the emergency does kick in, it's a seamless integration, correct?
Yes. There's no system where someone has to go out and start the diesel generator. Your lights don't go off, your computer screens don't go dark for a few seconds until the diesel generator kicks in, because of the onboard electronic management system, it's a seamless conversion. So if the utility line power is lost, you don't even see a flicker on your screen. It's very similar to the hallway lights that you're used to seeing that come on when the power goes off. It's just as seamless.
Wow. So then, if we could take a step back also, when you're saying that a company could plug these in on a regular basis, so they could operate 24/7, and then if you're, let's take a look at our utility bill again. We've had shows on this talking about sort of how commercial users could reduce their energy bills, and so there's a part of your bill is the demand charges. So those are when, you know, energy is at its peak. And in a tiered type system, that's its most expensive energy. So if you plug these in 24/7, you could potentially shave off that top layer. And in all my research, it shows that it could be up to 50% of your electricity bill, those demand charges.
Wow.
So if we plug those in 24/7, your payback time must be greatly diminished.
Well, yeah, it certainly brings that benefit. And one of the advantages is because it's a fully integrated system with its onboard power storage, which is different from a typical rooftop system, which only operates during the daytime. It allows you to program your electronics and modulate with your building power use so that when you are hitting those peak load or those most expensive consumption of electricity time zones, you can just flip over and draw from the unit. And typically, in a lot of urban situations where peak load is later in the day when the sun is already going down, when everybody's coming back from work, that's the time you can draw power and sort of level your utility bill.
Well, and I want to come to that. You know, we're talking about this as if it could be used both from an individual perspective as well as an industrial perspective. But the way I understand it is it's typically used at an industrial level. And so I know that especially in the disaster zones, the southeast, those places that get those hurricanes coming in and it's a disaster. And the power goes out. You know, I know it's used a lot in healthcare and the oil and gas industry, things like that. Can you talk about the solutions in those industry sets and the benefits? I mean, this brings such a value add to industry when they plug this thing in.
Well, certainly when we talk about industrial scale, one tends to think of large manufacturing and large scale power consumption. And this is not a tool for that purpose. When there's a loss of major power with a large scale industrial facility, that takes really big generators. And as we all know, area is important for collecting solar energy. So we're not saying that we're going to be able to back up a large industrial facility, but in terms of assisting or operating as a hybrid where this is paired with an existing backup generator, we now can create a lot of very unique economics as well as some zones of safety that can protect the business until they can respond to that major disaster. And for instance, operating as a hybrid, most commercial or industrial applications require inrush current or power surges to turn things on, which means generators, fossil fuel generators, typically have to be sized at 2 to 3, sometimes 4 times the average demand load in order to start equipment. We can provide that inrush current and that demand because it's only milliseconds at a time and it's going to be drawn out of the storage. The real benefit is that if it's paired with a generator and the generator is functioning as a true hybrid, the only time that generator is going to come on is when it comes on and operates at full peak efficiency, which means the fuel consumption, the maintenance cycles, all of that are going to be greatly reduced. So if you're used to paying, and I will just use a simplistic number, if you're used to paying $1,000 a week to operate a typical generator, you're now going to be paying maybe $300 or $400 a week to operate that same generator to generate the same power and reduce the amount of personnel time that have to be spent taking care of that generator, and they can be used for more important things, like in an emergency for repairs, saving lives, and getting food, shelter. It's very helpful.
Yeah, and that really is a critical aspect, is that when you really think about a disaster, like people are really scrambling, and And once again, we look at, we need power. We need power for everything.
Yep.
We need power for the water pumps and the gas pumps, and we need power for to maintain our cell towers. And so could you talk a little bit about, I know that you have sort of have a conceptual plan for providing these generators for about a 200-mile radius. That, I mean, that is this, the great thing about this technology is that, okay, say you positioned it wrong, you just haul it over to the next spot. You hook it up, you unplug it, you hook it up, and you haul it over. And so these neighboring counties could help each other in recovering from a disaster.
Wow.
Because that's really the key, is getting people back to work, getting that economics up, and it really has a big impact. So I know that was a kind of a roundabout question.
If you look at what happened during Katrina, and everybody remembers Katrina, there were a panoply of issues that even the best response can't deal with. The infrastructure was so badly damaged after Katrina that people who had backup generators, banks, clinics, pharmacies, critical government services, ran out of fuel in 2 to 3 days. The reason they ran out of fuel is because they couldn't get resupplied because the grid was so badly damaged, the fueling stations and the pumps couldn't be operated because they had no electricity. The second reason they ran out of fuel is because of all of the local regulations do not allow you to store vast quantities of fuel on site. It's too dangerous. There are too many issues associated with that. So all the backup generators did was prolong the inevitable in a disaster like that. The nice thing about a mobile solar generator is first of all, it can be hitched to the back of the fuel truck and taken to the refueling station because there's no risk of explosion, there's no spark, there's no heat. The fuel truck itself can haul one of these mobile generators behind it, actually take its own power and refill, so it can now reopen that logistical supply line. But number two, if these generators had been in place after the storm, they would be generating power, but they wouldn't have run out of fuel in 48 hours. They would have been able to keep things going until the infrastructure could be brought back to a remedial state so that normal supply lines could be reopened. And one has to question, because the economic disaster after Katrina was enormous, in those first 2, 3, 4 days, before the government decides it's got a disaster on its hand, before the declaration is made, before the logistics are mobilized to respond, what is the economic loss, the loss of life, the health crisis that occurs in that first 3 to 5 days? And this is where proactive mitigation is really important, because this equipment can be in place, it can be plugged in and operating. It can be folded down to weather the storm, so the flying debris and everything can pound away on it, and then as soon as the storm passes, reopened and you're in business. And those are issues on the proactive side of the equation that we never address in this country. Our whole approach to emergency response is 60, 70 years old and really hasn't changed.
Well, and we were talking before the show started that even during Katrina and as even smaller disasters have occurred, especially along that southeast coast. You know, you used a pharmacy example. You know, a lot of people really struggled because they didn't have the supply of medications or antibiotics or things that were needed from just a healthcare perspective. We're not even talking about the other things. Or even the food, the supermarkets, to keep things cold, you know, and keep things going. Can you talk about that and what some of those costs effective issues are, or cost issues are in those areas?
Sure. We were at an international hurricane disaster conference about a year and a half ago, and we were fortunate enough to meet General Russell Honore, who was the 3-star from the Army who was put in charge of the post-Katrina response after all of the issues that occurred with FEMA that we're well aware of. In speaking with the general, and he actually looked at one of our generators, and his comment was he had a health crisis on his hands when he got into New Orleans because all of the pharmacies had lost all of these antibiotics and vaccines, and the infrastructure was so badly damaged they couldn't resupply and get this to where they needed it the most. And his comment was, if we'd have had something like this in place, yes, they're not powerful enough to power an entire store,
right,
or an entire Walgreens or an entire supermarket. But the most critical aspect of a pharmacy in a situation like that is just the pharmacy. So the pharmacy's lights, its cash registers, and its refrigerator that holds all these critical antibiotics and prescription drugs can operate round the clock, and the health crisis can be avoided. No, people don't need to go into the pharmacy and buy their nuts and soda pop and eyeglasses after a crisis, but critical medicines, they're absolutely essential.
That's a good point. The pharmaceutical loss, I wasn't aware of how the value of all of that. If you could mitigate that across, say, if there are, say, even 10 pharmacies in that disaster zone, that's hundreds of thousands of dollars of mitigation for the cost of a couple of solar-powered generators. I mean, and so it's to me, this is a question of economics. This is a question of people sort of being accountable for protecting themselves in the event of an emergency, but then also, let's get moving right after an emergency and get people what they need and get the response in there. So how do you view your reception in the emergency management field, and what needs to happen for that all to engage?
I just want to point out one thing before I answer that question, and that is, if you travel in the Southeast right now and you look at all these critical services, police, fire, schools, pharmacies, neighborhood dialysis clinics, everybody has a backup generator. It's fixed. It's got its own fuel supply. So if a hurricane strikes a town 50 miles away, those generators are absolutely useless because they're fixed, they're localized. Because of all the rules and regulations surrounding backup generators, they just can't be moved. With a solar generator, one can put a group of solar generators in a typical pathway of a hurricane. And the nice thing about hurricanes, if you can use that phrase, are that they're tracked. We know where they're going to go. We know what they're going to hit and what they're not going to hit. So if I'm running a chain of 15 stores in a region, I don't have to have, like I do today, 15 backup generators that I have to check every month and manage fuel for. I can have 5 of these units, because I know within a couple of hours, 2 or 3 hours after the storm, I can move them in that 150 or 200 mile radius to protect all 15 of my stores. So the benefit is I'm now managing 1/3 of the assets that are going to give me the same protection as I had yesterday. The second part of that equation is those assets are working for me all the time between storms because they're plugged in, offsetting my utility bill. So the combination of those factors changes the whole approach to a proactive way in which we deal with emergencies.
Well, and they're relatively immediate. It's, ooh, I see the storm's taking a hard right. Let's go move them over there. And I love that it's that immediate solution, John.
Right. And you don't have to worry about, where am I going to get the fuel? How am I going to move the fuel? Mm-hmm. If I take it to this town, am I going to be able to keep it running in 2 days?
Sure.
Because are the fuel supplies local? Are they protected? All of those things now I do not have to worry about. I can take it over, I can set it up, I can program it, plug it in, and walk away from it and do more important things than worry about keeping my generator running.
So coming back to Kelly's question, you know, how does the emergency response community regard? How are they embracing the solar technology?
I think the biggest problem with the emergency response community is this whole proactive approach is new to them. And when you're dealing with an established bureaucracy that's been around and has done things the same way for 50 to 70 years, you can imagine the difficulty in trying to get them to refocus their thinking. We have had conversations with FEMA, and we get comments, and FEMA's a bunch of hardworking guys, and they get out there and they respond and they have to deal with very difficult situations. But comments like, this isn't in our mandate. Congress is going to have to change the way in which we're supposed to respond in emergencies. We don't have funding for this approach. We have funding for that approach. So there's some real challenges ahead. And I think this is an opportunity for the private sector to really lead, because if the private sector were to have a couple of networks that do what we're trying to convince the emergency response community to do and prove that it works when there is a disaster, I think then leading really, really, really helps, because it's very difficult to get government and established bureaucracies and established procedures to change in any short period of time.
But you would think, I mean, especially in the budget crisis that we're in, and in especially in the new energy industry, you're seeing a lot of conversation around the way subsidies are handled, especially in solar and these other things. And, you know, perhaps this is out of line, but you have a bunch of people sitting inside the Beltway who don't necessarily understand what happens on the ground in disaster recovery till after the disaster has truly occurred. And now it's time for the cleanup. And so I would think, I mean, you know, you talked about the private sector really needs to get out there and lead this conversation in a very proactive way because it's been reactive. How do you see that happening? Because I think that's absolutely the way it needs to happen. So many things are reactive, and that's why they cost so much more. They're 70 years old. It's technology that's old. There are better ways to do things. How do we lead these conversations,
well,
John?
I think there's a couple of opportunities. One of the interesting opportunities is the property and casualty insurance market. I mean, these folks have major clients that include thousands of pharmacies, thousands of neighborhood dialysis clinics, thousands of little markets that are going to lose all of their meat and frozen food. And when there's a disaster, the insurer not only has to pay for the loss, but the insurer also has to pay, in many cases, for business interruption. So they're paying on two levels. They're paying for the physical loss of the material, which we can all understand. But people who have business interruption policies, the insurer is also paying for the lost profits and revenue and the cost of running that business until they can get back on their feet. So there's a real benefit in that industry alone to first of all, avoiding the loss, and second of all, mitigating to some great extent the amount that they have to put out for business interruption lost profits. So if I'm the Walgreens chain or the CVS chain, either my insurer can look at it or I as a chain can look at it and go back to my insurer and say, you know, I've just put in a system now that's going to greatly reduce loss and greatly reduce business interruption, so let's talk about a change in the cost of that insurance. So it's a win-win for both sides, and that's just one example. Folks in the rental industry, folks in the telecom industry, folks in the field who run power because they're off the grid, we've learned that for temporary projects in the environmental industry, for instance, utility companies charge between $5,000 and $10,000 for a temporary power drop. So if I'm an environmental company, I may go out in the field to do an extraction well field for 3 or 4 months. I'm going to pay $7,000, $8,000, $9,000 for a utility drop to run my command trailer. This can negate all of that. Not to mention that if I'm in an environmentally sensitive area, I now have zero emissions and silence. And how long does it take to permit a project like that? If I'm going to do a well field in an environmentally sensitive area, I'm going to spend thousands of dollars in legal fees and permit fees. All of that can go away.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's amazing what can be done using these mobile power generators, solar power generators. But what has to happen, I think, is sort of take a step back and let's relook at this issue and let's relook at this problem. We're going to have to think outside of the way that we're accustomed to doing things, but by doing so, we save money, we save emissions, we save, we get people back to work. Maybe sometimes people aren't out of work, you know, and so.
Well, and you keep the status quo going to a certain extent in the middle of
chaos.
And I think that's so important. And, you know, we have to go to break, but when we come back, we'll have more with John Spezak from Solar Rover. I will have more with Kelly De La Torre. Don't go anywhere.
You're listening to Driving Force Radio with ICOSA. Once again, here's your host, Jan Mazzotti.
Welcome back to Driving Force Radio, where we seek to discover what drives today's leaders. My co-host Kelly De La Torre and I are sitting here having this fantastic and very interesting conversation with the CEO of Solar Rover, John Spezak. Welcome back to the show, John.
Thank you very much.
And thanks for always being here, Ms. Kelly.
Oh, thanks for having me.
John, you said something during the break that really struck me as we've talked about these mobile solar units and disasters and the proactive structures of issues as well as the reactive structures of all these issues around flooding and hurricanes, and but just even the nor'easters in the east. I mean, there's all kinds of issues. And you said the grid is stupid in this country. Can you tell me what that means?
We've heard both from the Department of Energy and also from the administration, but also from the Edison Institute and EPRI, the Electric Power Research Institute, that in order to accommodate our national goal of creating a lot of renewable energy, that the U.S. grid has to be made smart. The existing grid is not smart. It's an interconnected, managed system of power transfer around the country. But because of the way fossil fuels function, grid managers and power plant managers can turn on more generators, they can add more coal, they can turn on more natural gas turbines, and they can manage these surges and balances across the grid. Alternative energy is what's known as intermittent, and it's totally dependent on nature. No one can manage how much wind is going to hit a wind farm on any given day or hour. No one can manage how much sun is going to strike a solar farm on any given day or hour. They can predict reasonably well with meteorological data, but if a storm were to come or some other rapid fire activity were to occur that dramatically changes that power surge, the grid isn't equipped to manage those surges. And as we know, the grid in this country is stretched to its limits. Mm-hmm. We have brownouts routinely in the southeast, in the New Jersey, New York area, Southern California when the weather gets hot. So when you bring in and you start to depend on more and more intermittent energy sources, which is what alternative energy is, you have to make a major investment in making the grid smart so that it can react quickly, it can manage those surges, and it can change the way in which the grid handles all of its power demand. These various organizations have estimated that at least $500 billion over 15 years needs to be spent to make the U.S. grid smart. There's another even more critical issue than the smartness or the stupidity of the grid, and that's hardening the grid or power security. We've seen a major initiative in the last 2 years, 3 years by the Pentagon to bring a lot of our bases to what's called a net zero power consumption, so they are not dependent on the grid. We've seen that after major hurricanes or earthquakes, that U.S. military bases, which are critical for the security of the country, have lost power because they're dependent on this very fragile grid system in the United States. So power security is absolutely essential. You can imagine what would happen if some of our early warning missile detection systems or some of our military drone operations were to lose power.
Sure.
It's critical for national security. So we have a major initiative now to move critical bases and eventually most bases off the grid. Well, if the grid were hardened, a lot of that energy security would be dealt with. But if you think of the news programs you've seen recently and in the last few years, when there's a nor'easter or an ice storm or storms in the Midwest or after a hurricane, what do you see in the images? It's downed power lines and blown transformers. Well, a hardened grid puts most of those lines underground. It removes a lot of those surface connections which are vulnerable to natural disasters. The ultimate in energy security is what's called distributed power. If you're not relying on a grid and you have your own source of power close at hand, that is the most secure power you can possibly have. It's also the most expensive, but we've got to strike that balance. So again, you look at EPRI, you look at Edison Institute, you're seeing that estimates for hardening the U.S. grid, especially in those parts of the country that are most vulnerable, once again, this is another $500 billion or more dollars and another 15 or so years. Well, how much damage and economic impact is going to occur in those time periods until that's done? And today, given the budget stresses of governments at all levels, where is that over $1 trillion going to come from to both make the grid smart and harden the grid?
Right, and what's interesting to me are the parallels between we have discussions all the time about our energy security and how that relates to the military and how the military does have these new initiatives that, or ongoing initiatives, I guess I should say, about incorporating new technology. And if you compare the military issue with the emergency management issues, is that you're looking at critical infrastructure. You're looking at how can we make sure that our police and fire and our hospitals and clinics can get back up and running. And whereas in the military, you're also looking at that critical infrastructure, but there, it's even more dire. It's how can we make sure our troops in Afghanistan are safe, because those things are being powered from here. And so there are a lot of applications for this, not only in our U.S., but remotely. Could you talk a little bit about your interaction with the military on that?
Certainly the military in the last few years has really come to understand the importance of energy security in the field. Deloitte did a study for the Defense Department and the Army in 2009, which laid out the costs. As any good accountant firm, they'd focus on the cost, of course. But very interesting. In close-in situations, Deloitte estimated that there's a 30 to 45% premium on the cost of just the pump price in order to manage fuel supplies to off-grid equipment, whether that's generators or vehicles or whatever it is, because the pump price is only a fraction of the cost. The rest of the cost is in transporting that fuel and defending it. And then when they get out into the remote forward operating bases all over Iraq and all over Afghanistan, the price jumps to as much as $400 a gallon, because fuel has to be airlifted. It has to be bunkered. It has to be defended 24/7. It gets contaminated in sandstorms. So the military, besides the criticality of the mission, is also facing the same cost stresses that the rest of the country is facing. And when you start to look at fuel that's $100, $200, $300 a gallon, it's very significant. But the other key thing that Deloitte discovered, and I hate to put it in these terms, but as accountants will do, they created a factor which was called casualties per convoy. And this is a real loss of U.S. life, that with the number of convoys, and in the year they did the study, they estimated worldwide that the military moved something on the order of 3 million fuel convoys to support their operations worldwide. And in Afghanistan and Iraq, with the exposure to IEDs, RPGs, and just general combat, it's a toll that's taken in resupply, in real lives, maiming and injury. Sure. And that is something that everyone, including the DOD, is focused on, that has to be reduced. And if we can reduce the demand for fossil fuel from the military in the forward operating bases, even by 15%, we are saving real lives. And they understand that. And we've had discussions with the Department of the Army. We recently delivered a prototype unit that was requested by the U.S. Navy. We sent that to one of their prime contractors, who's integrating that with a hydrogen fuel cell system. But again, the focus was very clear: something that's tough, something that can substitute for a diesel generator in the field, very simple to operate so that the troops can understand it. One of the things the military has been struggling with alternative energy is the complexity. When they move in a combat situation to a forward operating base, they want to be up and running in minutes, not days or half days or hours. Sure. And they want to be able to do it with a single individual. They don't want to have to deploy a crew of folks, because their personnel is stretched very thin in the field. They have a lot of duties that they have to accomplish. And these are the benefits that we can bring. And we're starting to get some recognition from the military now that this is really important and can really help.
I am so glad to hear that, John, because you do hear these stories. And while I had some idea about the costs of these convoys, I had no idea how many actually run, and the casualties that go along with it. I think you missed that in the news that goes through, and certainly from a cost perspective as well as the human toll on it. It's something we must address as a country as we go forward. Looking at that, you know, and John, one thing that struck me as you were talking, especially on the bases that we maintain around the world, is there has got to be some applications in developing countries for this technology.
And, you know, the question is always, and I'm not talking about NGOs. I'm not talking about just giving them away. I'm talking about there has got to be applications in many developing countries, because we know that that new technologies really bring up, rise up, you know, that those communities. Are there applications in other countries? What are you seeing from that perspective?
Well, there's enormous applications in the developing world. We've looked at a number of countries in both East and West Africa. We've looked at countries in the Caribbean, which are both suffering from the developing world status, but they're also in Hurricane Central. So they get hit twice. And what we've concluded is that there are literally tens of gigawatts of generating capacity that needs to be built and installed and transmitted to bring these countries just up to rudimentary current power demands. Standard of living, the economies of these countries are greatly impacted by their inability to distribute power. You get into remote villages, the standard of living, the life expectancy, the health, the lives of women, because they bear most of this burden in these rural villages, can be dramatically improved if they had rudimentary power. The issue that we see in countries like Sudan, that it's been racked with war, and Ethiopia, and other countries that have had a lot of political conflicts, is that as the grid infrastructure expands, it's used as a mechanism to hold rural villages hostage because their power is cut. People who have generators, and in these countries they have tens of thousands of generators, again, it's used as a manipulative political tool because their fuel supplies are cut off. The roads in which the resupply trucks operate are taken over by rebels or bandits, or villages have to pay tribute to the warlords who are controlling their fuel supply. All of this goes away. A village can be in 100% control of its own power if it has an integrated mobile solar generator. It can pump its own water. It can provide lights for its children to study at night. It can provide some fans to cool the school. It can keep a small amount of perishable and very important medicines on hand at the village locally, instead of waiting a week for some medical truck to come if there's an epidemic. So the standard of living dramatically increases. People can use microwaves and hot plates now instead of cooking over charcoal, which with all the carcinogenic and toxic fumes. So in the developing world, the need, it's not just a demand, it's a real need, because they're facing at least a generation or more of realistically getting distributed or transmitted power from any new power facility. The issues of corruption and disruption and political instability, even if they need 15 or 20 years that are estimated to bring that power to these villages, it's probably twice that. Mm-hmm. And then they're going to be vulnerable even so.
Yeah, it's amazing the impact that just a tiny bit of electricity can bring to a community. And, you know, there are stories about communities that received, you know, the machines that will grind the corn. Mm-hmm. So that it used to take the women all day to do that, and it opened up a world of possibilities for them. Or the ability for buses to text, okay, we are actually going to be at this stop, that six-hour walk for you, instead of people walking that 6 hours and seeing the bus not there and walking back. I mean,
well, and I know when I was in Africa, we spent 5 hours a day, me and the girls, hauling water.
Yeah.
And so just the pump alone, from a water hauling perspective, and me being very American, by the third day, I was like, this is ridiculous.
Yeah.
Look at our girls, we're driving to the pump.
Yeah.
And then we'll drive back. But you actually open up an opportunity for a whole new generation of young women to be educated and to go into this totally different place as well. And I can certainly appreciate the water hauling part.
Well, think about a village that may have put in a well, mm-hmm. or have a well close by. Someone's going to have to go and pump the water and fill the jugs and transport the water. But even so, that water can't be used for agricultural purposes. They still have to depend on the rain. Mm-hmm. If one can put a small electric mm-hmm. pump in that well, one can take an ox cart and haul, or a pair of oxen or water buffalo, and haul one of these generators to the site for the day. And they can run that pump, They can water their field, they can grow their crops, they can fill a tank and bring it back to the village.
Wow.
And then they can still have power in the evening, yeah, to run some fans and some lights so the children can study.
So, John, what would one cost for a village? Just a regular size one, nothing fancy and high-powered.
Well, you've hit the issue, because a unit for a village like that we're talking about is probably somewhere around $30,000, which sounds like an insurmountable sum for someone in that part of the world. But it's basically a one-time cost.
Mm-hmm.
They have to keep the solar panels clean and keep the mud and dust off. And other than that, you know, once it can be pre-programmed for them, they're built on a very rugged structure. It's going to give them years and years and years of good, solid operating life. So the question is, how do we support that? Because when you think of the cost of bringing a transmission line to a village, it's going to exceed that. When you think of the cost of having a small diesel generator that they may buy for a couple $1,000s, but now they have to keep it fueled, yep, and taken care of for that same time period,
sure,
it's going to far exceed that.
Yep.
So the question is, in a package, one-time expenditure, how do you support these villages, or how do you get folks to be able to do this? But the other part of the equation is how do you measure the benefit of greatly improved standard of living, improved commerce within the country? Because if this village can grow a few crops more than they need, they're now going to be able to sell them to another village. It's the classic economic benefit that you get multiples of benefit from a single investment.
Absolutely.
So how do you envision? I know that you've had conversations with some countries in some pretty remote areas. How do you envision that rolling out? Are you making progress in that?
We're trying to get some interest on the part of organizations, philanthropic organizations, mm-hmm, as well as organizations like government organizations like USAID, as part of the State Department, and trying to see if they will look at this in a new and different way.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
From a U.S. aid perspective, this is something that establishes an American reputation, mm-hmm, and an American benefit for the long term. It's not providing something that's going to be consumed and forgotten about. I mean, if you give a mobile solar generator to a village, they're going to remember that country for years and,
yeah,
years and years, because this thing is going to improve their standard of living. Every good thing that's going to happen to this village, they're going to think about, well, this came from America.
Well, you decrease the amount of aid that's needed from other U.S.
Right.
organizations,
yeah,
and NGOs, from a food perspective all the way to healthcare to just the basic needs of people in those communities. Sorry,
right,
to interrupt.
No,
you, John.
That's fine. If a village can grow its own food, it doesn't have to be dependent on UN food,
yeah,
supplies every couple of months to,
right,
to bring in.
Right.
And if they're not being held hostage by the warlords on the highway to their diesel fuel deliveries, or their power lines being cut, it's independent, it's secure, it's distributed. That village can control its own destiny.
Well, bringing it back to the United States and talking about our education system and sort of bringing it full circle back to emergency planning, I know that schools are used a lot as emergency facilities, that people go to these schools for shelter. Are there opportunities with our schools? I mean, I could see opportunities where you would have this unit, you could plug it in, it could run this, at least a portion of the school's energy, and then you could do units that you could teach the kids, that they could actually have this hands-on unit talking about sustainability and our energy use, and really bringing up a generation of children that are aware of all of these issues and at the benefits that electricity brings. Are there opportunities in that arena for expansion?
Well, we would hope that we're going to make some progress and get people to look at that. The issue we've been facing ever since the start of this Great Recession has been the fact that school districts, government agencies, everyone has no money today, and it's getting worse. The deficits are, yeah, continuing to balloon. Budgets are getting squeezed tighter and tighter. The military's facing some enormous budget cuts over the next 10 years with a very large one if we don't have a congressional budget pact before the end of the year, striking in January. So I think at the military level, they understand that now the saving money is part of their equation. Before, the critical mission and protecting the troops was number one. It didn't matter what it cost. But I think there's a understanding now that one can't do either of those things if the money supply is going to be restricted, and it's clearly going to be restricted. So now they're looking at ways of how can we maintain that same level of readiness, that same protection, and do it at a reduced cost. And the same holds true at every level of government. If the local police station can have one of these units offsetting some of its utility bill, but know that it's fully protected in an emergency, there's a benefit. Same with the school, same with the fire station. I think the other critical issue is the way in which government acquires funding. Capital expenditures are horrifically difficult because they're multi-year and they have to deal with elections and bond issues. Annual budgets for like leases or rentals are much easier because they can set those with annual tax levies, they can set those with annual appropriations. So there's a built-in conflict here where you have a piece of equipment that is that needs a large chunk of capital up front, but then costs virtually nothing for the next 10 to 20 years, and that's not how government functions. Government functions on an annual tax and spend basis, mm-hmm. and that's a conflict. It's a struggle.
So, John, do you guys, I mean, obviously you sell them, but do you also do any sort of leasing programs with the equipment that Solar Rover builds?
We would love to be able to do that. The issue for us is raising the capital to be able to build a fleet that we can then do that with.
Got it.
So it just seems that in all of our discussions today that we're talking about we need to really kind of rethink how we're approaching some of these things. And it's a switch like we started with from reactive to proactive, but it's all the way down the chain almost.
Yeah, it touches every aspect of everything we do from
yeah.
the most powerful people in government down to folks that don't even have an electric light or a stove
yeah.
to be able to cook on. And
yeah.
so it absolutely does touch each and every one of us. But I want to talk about just one thing that you shared with us before we started the show that was a fun story.
Yeah.
It's not about danger. It's not about disaster. But you have this great story out of New York City. Share that with us, John.
Oh, this took place about 2.5 years ago. A company called Sun Crystals had a national contest. And I don't even know what the contest was about, but we were approached by a company that Sun Crystals had retained to provide power for this particular event. The event was the folks who entered this contest were going to be rewarded by a wedding paid for by Sun Crystals. It's an all green wedding right across from City Hall in New York City. And they came to us because they wanted to use a solar generator. And they put it in the center of the wedding in this beautiful garden setting in New York City. Draped it in green silks, and the orchestra was on one side of the generator, and the minister and the wedding parties of about 20 or 25 couples were on the other side, and it was literally the centerpiece of this wedding, and it powered everything for the wedding yeah. with absolutely no sound and absolutely no emissions. And we were joking with them that we probably could have put this in the back of a church because again, absolute zero emissions and absolutely silent. So it was a fun thing that we were able to do, but it kind of proved the point that first of all, it's now wireless power.
Right.
Second of all, it's totally clean and it's totally silent. And oh, by the way, it's also cost effective. It didn't
yeah.
need a subsidy. It didn't need a tax credit. To outcompete a fossil fuel generator.
John, how do people find more? We're running out of time. How do people find out more about Solar Rover?
Well, certainly our website, which is solarover, solarover.com.
Okay.
And that's the best way to start, and they can contact us from there.
So always check in at solarover.com and check out more about this fantastic technology that's going on from Solar Rover. John, thank you so much for being with us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And Kelly, as always, great show.
Yeah, I can't wait for the next one.
Yeah, it's always fun doing this with you, and I always learn so much.
So do I. Amazing.
Well, thanks for joining us this weekend. Have a great day, and join us next week.